Welcome to the ISF Podcast from the Information Security Forum. The ISF Podcast is hosted by ISF CEO Steve Durbin, and every episode he brings listeners features timely conversations, practical insights, and resources for global cybersecurity professionals. I'm producer Tavia Gilbert. Today, Steve is in conversation with Dr. Christopher Ankerson. Chris is a clinical professor of global affairs at New York University, where he leads the Global Risk Specialization Program at the Center for Global Affairs. He and Steve discuss the current global threat landscape, how to plan and run effective tabletop exercises, and why it's crucial for global security professionals to be aware of each of their enterprise's locations and each location's role in the business.
So hi, Chris. Thanks for joining me today on the podcast. Great to have you on the show. You are a clinical professor of global affairs at NYU currently, and prior to joining NYU, you worked at the United Nations. You've also taught at a variety of other universities around the world, including the London School of Economics. And in addition to all of that, you've been a serving officer in the Canadian military, and you're also the author and editor of several books that look at things like the politics of civil-military cooperation in various different environments all around the world. So you're well-equipped, hopefully, to have somewhat of an expert view on global risk and security. So to start with, share with our audience, what are the greatest coming threats that you see, and what does this actually mean for global security dynamics over the coming years?
Yeah, it's a great question, Stephen. It's a question that keeps, you know, the people who are paying attention up at night, obviously. The first thing I would say is, this is one of the biggest problems, is that we tend to look for single causes. We want there to be a threat or a big threat, when actually, I think what we're actually dealing with now is the combination of a multiple number of influences and drivers that are combining in ways that we are not able to understand. So I would think that complexity right. of the global system. So, for example, many people have tried to make the case that we are entering a new Cold War with China. And that has a particular resonance with people, especially people of a particular age that understand what a Cold War means. And it's something familiar that we could return to, when in actuality, the complexity of the relationship between China, for example, and any country in the West, but let's use the United States as the example, is infinitely more complicated than the relationship was between the USSR and the United States during the Cold War, but also be much more multi-leveled. We've got economic ties. We've got university research ties. We've got political ideological ties to, for example, opposition groups. We've got diaspora groups that are much more integrated. So trying to make these single episode or single idea issues to say that's a big threat, that's a big threat, I think actually underplays the combination. What would it mean to not only enter into a kinetic war or even a relatively aggressive Cold War, but also simultaneously have the economic knock-on of a severing of economic relations? Those two things happening simultaneously are going to be fruit for much more disruption in the West than we would ever have expected during the Cold War. The trade relations between the United States and the USSR, the Eastern Bloc, were minuscule in comparison with that of China. Add to that, for example, the substrate of climate change and how that will affect, for example, how certain countries react to a great power conflict between China and the United States. And we're entering into, again, almost a three-body problem, where the ways in which these single variables can combine, it's very unlikely that we're going to end up with a repeat in any particular way of what we have seen before. So I think the desire to answer that question is going to be to focus on, you know, the lists of top 10 risks that come out in the end of the year or the new year timeframe often see these things as separate variables. It's going to be climate change. It's going to be crypto. It's going to be China. It's going to be Russian aggression, whatever it might be. And I think they underplay the combinatorial effect that these have.
Yeah, I would agree. I think that increasingly, you know, as we talk to our members, particularly around the threat landscape, we do talk about this combination of different threats. You can't look at them purely in isolation. And we've moved to try to create scenarios so that we move much more to scenario planning in that kind of environment, which I think for people who haven't actually moved into that space is quite a mind shift, you know, to begin to think like that. What sort of advice do you have for people listening to this who actually are sort of hearing that and saying, okay, well, how can I now meaningfully mitigate some of this, you know, combination of different threats that are out there? What is it that they can do?
Yeah, I think the first thing, as you say, Steve, is that if we're talking about risk management, we're talking about uncertainty management. Anytime we have a certainty, we're really not talking about risk anymore. So if I have to worry about something that is going to happen definitely, then it's not really a risk calculation anymore. It's be prepared for the thing that is right. going to happen, right? That is much different than actually worrying about things we don't know what they're going to look like. The one thing I would say is not to lose sight of this combinatorial effect. So many people are, for example, saying we have to worry about cybercrime, or we have to worry about cyber espionage, or we have to worry about other specific forms of cyber attack. When actually, more and more we see that it could easily be a criminal gang that has been hired by a cutout somewhere that could be doing the work of a state somewhere. And therefore, what we dismiss as being merely an issue of cybercrime could well have been a reconnaissance run for something to come later. It could have actually dropped off a payload other than just stealing of information. It could have allowed for a backdoor in the future. So I think our desire to pigeonhole what comes at us to try to put it into a bucket that is certain. Oh, that was only a denial of service attack. We can deal with it. We're back up and running mm-hmm. in 45 minutes. Good to go. We've solved that. Move on right. to something else is probably in many cases, not all cases, underplaying the potential that could actually be looking at. So much more appreciating how diverse, how things might look like a duck and quack like a duck, but actually aren't a duck on the surface. If we're dealing with risk, we have to be, I think, in some ways skeptical. We have to be worrying about what else this might be, what this might be an instance of, rather than trying to get to certainty and therefore move to a checklist, move to some way of saying, okay, now we know what to do. This is an X. We have a checklist for X and we can move through that. That's the first thing I would say. The second thing I would say, and it comes from a friend and colleague of mine who was involved in wildfire management and the evacuation of, if you remember, the Fort McMurray fires a few years ago in Northern Canada. Mm-hmm. He said, our worst case scenarios are no longer bad enough. In the sense that when we're talking about scenario planning, there's no point in planning for something that we already know how to deal with. And again, it's very similar to the first point. We need to make scenarios that are in some ways stretch goals, that are not necessarily realistic, but are potential and are going to make us improvise, make us come up with things that we don't have checklists for. And otherwise, if we're making scenarios that are just, this is what happens every Wednesday afternoon, that can be good training. That can be a good way of developing those checklists. But it's not the same as what you're talking about, is preparing for uncertainty through the development of scenarios that are going to be in and of themselves unrealistic, in the sense that they're going to be perhaps extreme. They're going to dial up certain variables beyond what we would anticipate. But the point of that is showing us where we actually have blind spots. The third thing I would say is that risk itself, the approach to dealing with threats, vulnerability, and all of that, is in and of itself a human construct. We are not measuring something in the environment. If I want to measure temperature, I can use the wrong scale, I can use Fahrenheit, or I can use the right scale, I can use Celsius. It doesn't matter. There is some underlying thing physically in the universe that I'm measuring, which is the acceleration of molecules, for example, and that causes temperature, and I can measure it either going up or down. And the units may be arbitrary, but the phenomena is real. When we're talking about risk, we are not measuring danger in the environment. There is no underlying mm-hmm. reality that we can kind of tap into with a probe. It doesn't matter how many decimal places we put on our 5x5 risk management chart. We're not actually tapping into something real that is actually measurable. We are narrating risk. We are anticipating and talking into existence in some ways, the things that could go wrong, which are very unlikely to be that way when they actually do happen. So I think we have to realize that, you know, as an academic, we talk about risk being a social construct. What that means is you're not going to get good at measuring the danger, right? That's not something we can put our hands around. So all of the scenario planning we do, all of the preparation is going to be in some ways imaginative. It's going to be constructed. It's going to be a future that we talk into existence and use that as a foil to see how well prepared we are for things that oftentimes will never happen. But if they do, we perhaps have stumbled upon a way of preparing for that kind of eventuality that may occur in a way that we never anticipated.
Now, I can well imagine some people listening to this thinking that, well, that moves me to a very uncomfortable place because as a, say, a chief information security officer or a chief risk officer, I'm having to explain to business colleagues and they are expecting a certain degree of certainty in terms of, you know, what might happen and so therefore how we might go about dealing with it. And then when they've got that nailed and they've rehearsed it, they feel pretty good. But what we're talking about is a million miles away from that. So how can you, I'm particularly thinking about a chief risk officer or a chief information security officer, what are some of the things that you've seen and perhaps taught that can help people to build trust and to successfully communicate, collaborate across all of these different entities in a business or in a government area in order to be effective, in order to overcome that particular, you know, uncertainty, uncomfortable feeling?
Yeah, excellent point. The first thing I would say is we have to avoid, not a new statement, we have to avoid stovepipes, right? Okay. If we are only worried about information security and we say, well, it wasn't us that failed, it was facilities that failed because it was the air conditioning that went out and that took the server offline. It had nothing to do with the IT department, for example. That's not helpful to the business, right? The business says, I want a certain level of dial tone. I want a certain level of functionality. So divvying things up into smaller and smaller responsibilities is going to lead to that blame game where you're technically right, but you're absolutely wrong in terms of the combined effect in terms of delivering that consistency to the business side. So we really have to see crosstalk. And again, you know, the notion of a chief risk officer who has enterprise risk management across the business is in a slightly better position to see where those risks might come. And I would anticipate that a risk officer is going to see those junctions that we used to say in the Army, right? The problem always happens where the map joins up. So where there are those seams between responsibilities to really try and exercise that and see, hey, are you anticipating that Dave's going to have a problem? Mary, what are you going to do if Dave has a problem? Not so much only what's on in your patch. That's the first thing I would say. Right. The second thing, and this is perhaps counterintuitive, is we often do crisis management training. We often do disaster management training by saying the very first words out of our lips, a crisis has happened, do something about it. And that can be useful to do that kind of training and drilling, as you say. But oftentimes I'm finding more and more now, the first step is actually the step before that, which is, are we in a crisis? Is this actually worth doing our crisis response type protocols? So rather than anticipating some bolt out of the blue that is very clearly an accident, a disaster, a crisis, to exercise the ambiguity and say, first step, do we call the boss? Do we pull the handle? Do we push the button? Do we say this is an emergency or not? And live in that uncomfortable ambiguity for a minute and say, how would we know that we were in this emergency phase, which we all then kind of resort to drills and everything else. How do we actually anticipate and prepare for that very uncomfortable decision-making process that is undefined by definition? What happens a minute before an emergency? We don't even have a term for that, right? What's the pre-emergency uncertainty that we have to be good at saying, you know what? It's going to cost me money, but I think we need to do that thing now. We need to be able to work together and break the rules and do this kind of combinatorial, all heads together type stuff that we normally reserve for emergencies. How do we know what the trigger for that is going to be? And if we play around with that and cutesy it up and make it certain, we're probably losing the point, which is at some point, we're not going to know what's going on. And that those decisions in that period are what are really going to make the difference.
Right. Some good advice there. We're in a period, obviously, of what seems to be intensifying geopolitical instability. How do you think organizations can better equip themselves to navigate the challenges of global operations, differing regulatory environments, cultural nuances, so that they can establish somewhat consistent and effective cybersecurity and risk practices across diverse regions? Any thoughts there?
I think the very first step in that, Steve, is to actually map out what your environment is, because I think you will be surprised by how few people actually understand, well, we're headquartered in New Jersey or we're headquartered in London. That's true. But the extent, the actual virtual map of that company and the places and the jurisdictions within which it sits, whether it's legal as offshore or the finance back offices in Hungary, and then we've got a supplier, vendor networks elsewhere, to actually sit and create this supply chain map to understand where you actually are, where your vulnerabilities are, therefore, where, as you say, special handling instructions apply in terms of things like GDPR, but also other national jurisdictions. For a company to actually know, essentially have a sense of where they are in the world is the first step, because so few companies actually have a good understanding of that, whether it's legal, whether it's logistics, whether it's finance, whether it's HR, all of that is ultimately going to be the first step in trying to design what you do. So yelling down the phone and saying, do the thing, do the process that we're talking about, someone else on the other line going, I don't know what you're talking about, that's illegal here, or we're not allowed to do that here, right, is going to be a problem. So that very first thing is to actually map out where are we in the world, and therefore figure out from there what those complexities are going to be.
Yeah, and I'm glad you mentioned the supply chain, because, you know, a number of certainly our members were, I certainly think were and indeed are still being impacted by the ongoing war in the Ukraine, of course. But we've also seen other incidents more recently. I'm thinking in particularly of what's been going on in West Africa, you know, military coup in Niger, and more recently, of course, in Gabon. But those are just, you know, a few examples of destabilizing events in what is an increasingly unstable world, in which increasingly we're all operating across different geographic boundaries. And I'm curious, based on your experience, you know, for organizations that perhaps have no other option but to continue operating in conflicted regions or under volatile circumstances, what should central leadership be doing in terms of risk management to support people, you know, who are actually on the ground and need to continue to be productive and, most importantly, perhaps remain safe? You know, we can't just leave everywhere when it becomes volatile, can we? What should they be doing?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point to bring up, that in many jurisdictions, there is a duty of care from management. But even if there isn't, there should be an ethic of care, right? That there needs to be a concern for the ability to not only carry on the business, but also the concern for the human beings that are doing that. And often those come into tension. As you say, if you're too risk averse and the idea is evacuate or, you know, switch off as soon as there's a whiff of cordite in the air, you're going to have a difficult time to operate long term. And if that's the case, I would say that if you are that risk averse, then you really need to figure out, again, doing that mapping exercise, don't put people into positions where the first thing you're going to do is necessarily pull them out of there, right? The short term advantage of, let's say, cheaper labor costs or whatever, if it's going to mean that you're going to have to then pull people out every who knows when, that might be a question to say, do we really want to be there in the first place? Mm-hmm. The second thing I would say is, you know, I think you really have to understand the value of what you're doing. What is it that that office, that node in your particular network is doing for you? Is it, for example, relations with other vendors? Is it doing some kind of monitoring and evaluation supervisory task? Can that be done in a different way? Are there other modalities that that office can achieve that? Are they actually doing production and therefore it's actually individual coders that may be caught up in the violence, you know, without having to worry about your expat staff? So actually understanding what's going on there, what value that node is doing, can allow you to sit there and say, well, what, you know, play some scenarios. What would happen if there was a civil war and we've got, you know, people in the orange group versus people in the purple group? Does that affect us in any way? Are there ways in which we can mitigate that by saying work from home? If we look at, for example, some of the general strikes that were going on in Bangladesh for a few years, they were very disruptive to logistical companies or transport companies that physically needed to move around. But if you had a workforce that was able to work from home, you could continue on relatively problem-free. As long as your worker wasn't actually trying to move around a city and cross a checkpoint, it wasn't such a big deal. So actually understanding, again, taking that map that we just did, but actually figuring out what goes on, what does that node actually do and how do they do it? Then you can start devising ways in which, rather than just evacuate, or rather than just lock down, can we actually come up with ways of achieving that same goal in a way that isn't going to jeopardize either the process or the people who are doing it? But again, so many times we don't really know what's going on. It's really just a pin in a map, or it's a light on a PowerPoint slide and saying, coup, close it down, or evacuate it. Or more tragically, oftentimes, don't do that because we don't really know what's going on. This happens all the time. The locals know what to do, blah, blah, blah. And we're going to rather callous in that sense. So I think, you know, mapping step one, but then an actual functional understanding of what they do allows you to be much more creative in your mitigation and involve those people. Ask them. I was working with a client who was in Afghanistan. And when the Taliban reasserted control of first Kabul and then the rest of the country, you know, it was the first step was let's ask the locals what they want to do. What are they comfortable with? What are they actually looking for in terms of support? And in many cases, it was give us a couple weeks to figure out, you know, what the new kind of way of working is, and we will come back to you with some suggestions rather than coming up with a crisis management meeting minuted kind of I need to know right now. It was give us a couple weeks to wait and see. And that turned out to be very useful in terms of maintaining a presence and an operational ability for that company in that country.
I think that's a really valid point there, because I think that from a security standpoint, from a cyber perspective, we are all too keen to rush into our crisis management response. You know, we've got the playbook, we know what to do, we've got to dive in there. And the value in what you're just talking about there, I think, is just pausing, just stepping back, just really assessing the situation. And when I think to a lot of the sort of cyber simulation exercises that we run around the world, one of the things I notice is that perhaps all too often, when we've placed this scenario in front of people, they immediately dive in. You know, they're into problem solving, right? How do we get this fixed? And we probably don't see enough of people sitting back and saying, okay, let's just take a breath. Let's figure out exactly what's going on. Let's gather all of the information together that's available, and then let's go from there. One other thing that I thought was really valuable that you've been saying that's coming across here that I do just want to pull out again for listeners is this need, in fact, to really focus on what you can control and then use that as your jumping off point for what, of course, you cannot control. And from a senior executive perspective, that gives me comfort because now I know what I'm starting with and what I can rely on, as opposed to what, again, all too often happens when you get into these crisis situations where everything is moving everywhere. And again, you feel as if perhaps you don't have some of these anchor points. Would that be fair? Would you endorse that?
Yeah, I mean, I think we like to say about people and about cultures, a bias for action, right? You know, we're going to lean into it. We're going to jump on things right away. And this is often facilitated by things like templates. And we've already done this in exercise. And again, it's this feeling of certainty. There's a certain addiction to crisis. People love to, especially in fields that are dealing with it all the time, we like crises, right? It's right. Throw the rules out the window, roll up the sleeves, and get into that sweaty kind of adrenaline rush and the bias for action to go and kind of put fingers into holes and figure things out can be quite soothing in a sense. When actually that sitting back, taking a pause, taking a beat, not days, not weeks, but taking a beat, trying to figure out what the pattern actually is, and maybe what we might say a bias for understanding as the basis for good action rather than just bias for action is where we should be looking. Now, again, we can take that to an extreme and this notion of contemplation for too long and, you know, wanting always one more piece of information. It's an uncomfortable place. It's an uncomfortable place to say, I need to know more or less what's going on, or at least have an understanding of what that is, with an appreciation for what the second and third order effects might be of what I'm going to do or what I'm not going to do, but also having the ability to put things into place relatively quickly and people who aren't afraid to get their hands dirty. None of this is easy, right? If this were easy, we wouldn't get it wrong so often. And often right. When we look at these things and after action reviews and the rest of it, we do see that it's either, you know, flight or fright. We see people freeze up and do nothing, or we see people who jump headlong into something and actually cause more damage than good. When actually, if we just took a breath, tried to figure out, what am I seeing here? Asking, you know, almost thinking out loud and letting people say, boss, I've seen this before, or no, I don't think this is what we saw before. We need to be a little bit more careful here. Or who else could be playing in this space? Is this really as simple as it looks on the face of it? That little bit of discussion might be exactly what is required, rather than leaping onto page 17 of our playbook and implementing, you know, template X for the problem.
And I think one other point that you make there, which is really important, is the need for post-incident review. You know, once the dust has settled, once we've responded, and to be doing that in a non-judgmental fashion. I think a lot of people often find that, we're going to start finger pointing here. But no, it's about learning. It's about being able to take things forward and go again from there. Chris, been an absolute pleasure talking to you. Loads of really valuable insights there into the whole concept of risk management and security and what is becoming an ever more complex world and environment, not just for businesses, but also individuals and, of course, governments. So thank you very much indeed for sharing those insights. Been an absolute pleasure. Thank you, Chris.
Thanks, Steve. Thanks for having me.
Thanks to today's guest, Dr. Christopher Ankerson. We'll be back with a new episode next week. In the meantime, if you would take 10 seconds to pull up this podcast on whatever device you're listening, give us a 5-star rating and write a quick review, we'd be grateful. You can also listen to the ISF Analyst Insight podcast, which goes in-depth on the hottest topics in information security. In every episode, ISF analysts hand-select active security professionals from ISF member organizations to discuss how the implementation of ISF research is uniquely applied to their real-world context. We hope you'll listen, and of course, we'll put a link to that show in our show notes. If there's a topic or question that you'd like us to cover in a future episode, let us know at securityforum.org, which is also where you can find our catalog of past video and podcast episodes, as well as ISF's research, practical tools, and guidance related to discussions like today's. The ISF podcast is produced by TalkBox and Tavia Gilbert, with senior producer Katie Flood. Mix and master by Kayla Elrod. Music by Alexander Filipiak. Thanks for listening.